All right, everyone, welcome to the RSP cast, episode number 24. And this is a special cast for me because there are not many people that honestly that I do a lot of cross-checking in my work with when it comes to getting ready to do the RSP publication. I try not to look at other people's work. But one person that I like to look at as I go about, just to make sure that I haven't completely lost my mind with certain things and see if I need to go back and look, is actually Lance Zierlein's work, the NFL draft analyst for NFL.com, co-host of The Bench on 97.5. And today we're fortunate enough to have Lance on to talk some shop. Lance, welcome to the show.
How you doing? Great to be here again, Matt. You and I have, you know, we've been keeping track of each other and sharing thoughts for a long time. So it's good to catch up with you again.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. It's so funny because we'll kind of pass by and say hello at the Senior Bowl or an event like that. And, you know, it's kind of that time to be able to, you know, where things are getting pretty busy here. So it's nice to be at a kind of a period where there's maybe at least a slight lull.
Yeah, no doubt.
So with this slight lull, I figured it would be fun to talk shop with you about a variety of things. And I think from the first thing is, you know, from what I know about you and, it, you know, just personally, is that you were, I remember seeing something on Facebook where you shared some form of scouting that you did early on, even in like, I think in your teens, where you like sent an NBA GM some reports as a fan. So I'm just wondering, just aside from the importance of just the off-field stuff, how has your view of scouting evolved over the years?
It's really just become much more fine-tuned from a fan perspective to a team perspective, and they're two very different things. A fan perspective, a lot of times, will sometimes overvalue production, will sometimes overvalue level of competition, will sometimes undervalue physical measurements and traits and physical markers that are indicative of you know, opportunities to succeed. And I think one of the things I've really come to realize is that there are certain factors that lead to an ability to do something or an inability to do something. So, you know, before I would say you look at a guy's ability to succeed in the Big Ten and you think, okay, well, that will translate. But you can be a really good – and granted, we have years and years of this to look back at and see guys who have succeeded in college and failed in the pros. But it really – I really have come to realize that the NFL likes for players to look a certain way, and there's a reason for that. It's not just cliche. It's because loads of historical data tell you that certain – types of players have the greatest chance to become Hall of Famers, not just starters and not just Pro Bowlers, but Hall of Famers. So there's a reason that teams tend to strike early for certain physical and explosive traits. It's because it really can matter. And so I've come to recognize that and to always have an eye on that. I don't rely specifically on that. I think that there are always outliers, but I have come to the realization that it's not just cliche. It's not just a bunch of garbage that, you know, was spouted by Al Davis and you want to dismiss it as look at the guys he missed on. There really is something to it. And that's why so many successful general managers and organizations around the league have certain physical standards. Every single team has physical standards that they want players to reach because they don't want to have a team full of outliers. So I've come to realize the importance of changing. I can still think a player is a really good player, but I don't think he should come off the board until the third or fourth round, if that makes sense. Like, I understand that I can love a fifth rounder and tell you I think a guy should be drafted in the fifth, but still like him more than a guy that I think should come off the board in the second, if that makes sense.
No, that makes perfect sense, and I probably make a living based on that idea a lot just because of the idea that what you're stating is there's a level of risk management that's just involved with that data and also what you're going to pay a player. And so when you look at first round, I think that you're looking at first or second round, you're looking at a series of bullet points that reduce that risk? You know, what's their health history? What school do they play at? What kind of production did they have? Where do they fit within percentiles with those physical dimensions and then with the athletic measurements as well? And the more you have of those, the safer a GM's going to feel about being able to make those picks, because they can explain logically why this guy has potential to develop in the areas that he should be able to develop. But within that same range, I mean, there's also times where there's that notion of what I often kind of call is that draft capital idea that, you know, Ryan Riddle's a guy that I often cite with this, which is the idea that when you get into a training camp, maybe that fifth rounder, or maybe it's even a sixth or seventh rounder who doesn't have a lot of those traits or doesn't fulfill all of those bullet points, maybe he performs well, but he doesn't get as many reps. Maybe there's a little bit more bias towards the first round guy because there's the expectation that he's going to be that guy. You're paying him to be that guy. And therefore, maybe you give that guy 12 reps on, you know, maybe he's getting 12 reps in practice and he messes up four of them. And they're like, well, he's going to get better. And in the same practice, the fifth or seventh rounder gets, you know, six reps, if that. And maybe the same percentage of plays he makes the same type of mistake with, and they say, "See, I told you that he, you know, we know that he couldn't play, or he's a developmental guy, and he's going to need a lot more time." What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that's valid?
I do think it's valid, and I think that one of the things, and that's where it gets to the physical, you know, the ability to. I always go back to that. Does a player have the ability to do something? If he physically is limited, whether it's his speed in pursuit, whether it's his ability to physically turn and chase quickly, like he's a cornerback like Tavarius McFadden who had that issue, whether it is, you know, an inability to get off of blocks quickly because a player lacks length or you know, the twitch to explode in his upper body and separate from a guy. If there are physical limitations that limit their quote-unquote ability to do something, then teams are going to be less likely to worry about where coaching fits in and where that improvement can lead that player because they already see too many limitations. Conversely, players with the physical ability to do something are given a longer lifeline because they have that ability to do something. And so the thought is, let's see how long it takes for the player to take on the coaching and to, you know, I guess, translate the coaching from the practice field into a game. And so that's why those guys who are also, you know, also, by the way, the higher picks typically when they have physical traits, they get a longer lifeline. I think where you have the real, I think the real concern is, how quickly does a player learn? Does a player have good football IQ? And does a good player have good football character? Players with good football character, no matter what their physical limitations or strengths, you know, if you have good football character, that means you're more likely to spend the extra time in the weight room and in the film room. You're going to be a self-starter. It's going to mean a lot to you, so you don't want to fail, so you go that extra step so that you don't fail. Players with good football IQ, and obviously, Matt, conversely, the opposite is true. You might be playing a sport because it's a means to an end. You're playing it for financial gratification, maybe the fame of it. Maybe you like playing games, but you don't love the practices and the meetings. That's not a high football IQ, and you're a high football character, and you're less likely to do what it takes to take that next step against other professionals who are chasing after the same, you know, the same spots on a roster. If you have a high football IQ, you're more likely to be able to self-diagnose and self-fix certain areas in your game, whether it's as a running back with protections or whether it's as a cornerback in terms of recognizing double moves. If you're a guy who relies a lot on athletic ability or scheme, then when you get to the NFL, if your football IQ isn't high, then it's going to take you longer to learn. And let's face it, with the CBA, the new CBA, the way that it is, there's less time on the field to practice and get better than there's ever been from the standpoint of teaching, learning, and and becoming a smarter and a more well-rounded football player. And there's such a vast difference between college football now and pro football in terms of how the game is played, that that lack of additional time to really learn fundamentals in some cases and learn technique and improve the football IQ, that's being really strained right now. And so, you know, I think it's making it harder for young players who also are coming out earlier at record pace. You see all these things come together. It's a perfect storm of players who become underdeveloped once they get into the league. You've got to have teams who are really fine-tuned in terms of developing talent, because there's talent like Desmond Harrison. I did a radio hit for the Cleveland Browns radio station. We talked about Desmond Harrison. He's got tremendous talent. The rookie undrafted tackle from West Georgia, who might end up as a starting left tackle at some point this season for the Cleveland Browns. But taking that talent and making him a football player, you know, that doesn't happen overnight. And that could be something Cleveland could rush into prematurely. And once they have the patience to stick it out with a guy who is going to need some patience and some coaching and repetition, because he's been limited from a football standpoint.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and it's one of those things that when you talk about having that technique and learning those techniques, it's about doing so at the speed of instinct, being able to react to what you see in a manner where it almost seems instinctual, but really it's from really over and over again, drilling that and looking at all the different types of possibilities and becoming comfortable with that motor skill language that you're acquiring. So let's move on a little bit to some players who maybe have taught us some important lessons in evaluating players. You know, I mean, I think some of the guys, I remember Demaryius Thomas was a player I missed on big time, because I just, as I was gaining more experience about receiver technique and different types of skill sets, I didn't place enough in value on how much a player could learn. And whereas you were talking about having those types of physical skills and them having the opportunity to learn that and evolve, you know, Thomas absolutely did that. And in contrast, a guy like Russell Wilson was an example of a guy that I liked who may not have physically fit the mold, but conceptually, in terms of how he read the field, in terms of what he could do with the specific skills that he had, I liked. But that was, you know, and then at the same time, you know, you look at maybe I look at backs like Jay Ajayi or Ahmad Bradshaw, where they taught me a little bit more about the value of when you look at tape. Oftentimes I found that even if they didn't produce well in a given game against top opponents, that if they were executing how I mm-hmm. defined a process for them, how I defined what they should be looking at, where they should be trying to reach a crease, you know, whether or not they adjusted their stride, whether you could see that what they saw and how they made those adjustments matched, and that they were getting everything they could out of that play, even if that meant it was a 2-yard loss, that they were doing well. So who are some players that taught you important lessons about evaluating talent that you can think of off the top of your head?
Well, it's funny the way you position this, because I think first let me speak to the philosophy of because I think that's important. The philosophy of recognizing your flaws, being self-aware, because it's constantly a process. Once you've been doing this for a while, if you're not looking at where you missed, it's great to find out where you hit, but you really shouldn't. If you hit it, are you just gloating because you're very proud of yourself? And that's great. You should be proud. But where did you miss? Because that's where you get better. The great shooter can spend all the time shooting in the world that he wants to, but when is he going to work on the ball handling and the defense that is going to take him from being a specialist to a good overall player? So that's one of the things I think as an evaluator on any level, anybody in any sport, anybody who is analytical and has to evaluate for a living has to figure out where their process is a little flawed and how do you fix the process and do you learn? For me, I want to talk about that just for a second. One of the things that I learned, and I have to give Chris Ballard credit for this from the Colts, who's been kind of a mentor for me over the years, is don't get too caught up in the minutiae and then the fine details of technique and things that are coachable. Do players make plays? And that's what it gets down to. Is your guy around the play to make the play? Does he have the physical ability to make plays? That's how you project. Because ultimately, Matt, we're not doing – this is not supposed to be a summary of how guys played in college. We can do that, and a lot of people do make that mistake of summarizing a player's college, you know, a player's college career, and then doing it in a format of draft verbiage and wording. But realistically, you have to project, what is that guy going to look like in 3 or 4 years down the road on an NFL team? Is he likely to succeed? Where is he going to struggle? Where is he going to succeed? And you have to recognize that there is going to be some improvement for a 21 and 22-year-old if they're open to coaching and if they have physical ability. And I made a mistake on Marcus Peters. Marcus Peters coming out, this is the very first year I did it for NFL.com, and I gave him what amounted to a second-round grade, and I said, talented cover corner with size, ball skills, and the confidence NFL teams are looking for, but lacks the necessary discipline and maturity on the field and in practice. Peters has raw talent, but is far from a polished cornerback, and that is without taking the character concerns into consideration. If his character checks out, then he has a shot at going on the first day. Now, all that seems pretty fair. But when I go look at some of the weaknesses, I leaned too heavily on him not staying connected to routes. I didn't see him as a mirror and match cornerback. Well, guess what? Jalen Ramsey's not that either. And so those two guys came in back-to-back seasons, Jalen Ramsey and Marcus Peters, two of the preeminent cover corners in this league. And what I really learned from those guys is that you got to look for players who have at that position, be okay with Tre'Davious White, who's beautiful with mirror and match talent. Marshon Lattimore, beautiful with mirror and match footwork and transitions and smooth hips. That's great. That's one way it looks. But you know another way it looks? Maulers like Marcus Peters, who has great ball skills, will get out of position sometimes, but has the physical talent, the ball skills, and the length to make plays on the ball. And yes, making plays on the ball is something you either have it or you don't. And so that's another thing I learned. I should have paid more attention to what he could do on the field as opposed to the minutiae of, you know, not looking pretty all the time, not having it look exactly the way it's supposed to look. Get her done. I'm not sure how I could have missed on that, because as somebody who has studied offensive line for years and years, you know, ultimately it's supposed to look a certain way, but you also judge offensive linemen based on whether or not they get their guys blocked. Now, you're more likely to get guys blocked with good technique, and you're more likely to avoid, you know, holes in your game and being exposed if your technique is good. But ultimately, too many scouts in the NFL, I think, have gotten too caught up in how pretty guys are supposed to look on the hoof and what type of footwork they have, when really your job is to be a physical player who moves players out of the way, either by force or by leverage, you know, or by footwork. And so how did that player operate? Did he succeed? I didn't put enough credence into how he succeeded. And frankly, Jalen Ramsey, I had him as a number five player in the draft, so I didn't really, you know, miss too badly, but I should have seen this coming. I thought maybe he should be a safety, which he did play some safety at FSU and corner. But other NFL people that I trusted and spoken with, they were like, oh, this guy's going to be unbelievable. And I thought, well, I think he's going to be good. I don't know about unbelievable. Well, they were right, because he's the best corner in the league right now.
Yeah, and I think that makes a lot of sense because, I mean, again, you know, I think oftentimes when you're looking at a process, one of the things is that it's a multi-year thing. Looking at 1 year and reacting to how that player worked out, you know, that's one thing. But for me, I find that I need a few years to see what's going on, and I need maybe even a few classes to react to that and see what I should tweak and what I should change about how I go about doing it, because I don't want to overreact based on just 1 year of what I've seen based on what scheme that player's in or who they're performing with, and making sure that as I add to my process that I'm doing it in a in, I guess, a methodical way as much as that I can. So, and I appreciate what you talked about, the get or done aspect, or just, you know, looking at that there's different ways of doing it. And it's not just this technically pretty thing, because I know that, you know, you grew up with an NFL offensive line coach, and when I started this as someone who was just a fan and trying to define things and learn as I went. And it's one of those situations where, you know, I tried to learn as much about technique as I could, but at the same time, those lessons come into play, like you said, where it looks awfully pretty, but it's not getting done. And so learning that balance between, you know, where the technique needs to be there or where it doesn't necessarily need to be there as finely as maybe how it's written in the book.
Yeah, and I think if it looks pretty and it's not getting done because there's a physical limitation that is preventing it from happening. And I think one of the areas why I was able to step into the NFL job, they came to me in late October of 2014 and asked if I could, you know, if I was interested in this. And I said, yes. They said, well, it's 500 profiles. And frankly, I didn't know what I was getting into. I mean, how much work that was. And I didn't hesitate. You know, of course I said yes. But, you know, one of the things that I think was that I really figured out quickly was that the time that I had spent really grinding on the NFL, because at that time I was spending more time with the NFL. I did a lot of draft stuff, but I was one of those guys who went from the NFL into draft. Some people go from college football into draft. You know what I mean? There's the two worlds. Right. I would start in the NFL and then I would acclimate myself with draft stuff starting in January. So I knew what it was supposed to look like on the NFL. I spent so much time watching all 22. You know what I mean, Matt? Like, if you need to know what a starter looks like in the NFL. So if you're watching all college football, you're not going to know what a starter looks like in the NFL, because sometimes it looks different than you think.
Yeah, it's definitely that. I mean, and it's funny because one of the things that I've been trying to do as a design just of my site is call it, you know, I do articles called the NFL lens, which is just, I've always done the same thing as you, which is I look at NFL tape. That's what informs me. And then it's, while I look at college tape all year long, it's always about the NFL being that kind of lens that you view it through, because what's open in the NFL is different than what's open in college football. What's an accurate throw is different. You know, all of those things definitely have an importance, and especially with the range of techniques or craftiness or savvy and understanding of a variety of situations and what type of decisions are expected, it's far different, you know. So let's talk a little bit about rankings, because you just, you know, you touched upon where you had a couple of defensive backs ranked in the past, and I kind of see rankings as a necessary evil. I don't really like doing them. I mean, to be honest, and I write about that a lot, and just because I think the differences in values can be so small and the readers give too much weight to the ranking rather than the grade and the write up. And I understand why that you need to have a number there. And it's an important exercise on a certain level, but I don't like it necessarily. It's kind of like, it's like any athlete who does certain types of exercises. Some they like more than others. Those are the ones that I don't particularly like. How do you feel about rankings in general?
You know, I don't mind it in general because NFL teams have to stack boards. And so in a way you are ranking players by stacking those boards. So I don't mind that. I think the problem I have is going to be the same concern that you have, is that when people read my stuff and my rankings, I don't have a clearly defined team philosophy. I can't, you know, teams have philosophies. This is the kind of players we're looking for. This is the kind of defensive players we're looking for. Here's how we value them in the draft. I don't have that. I'm having to work with a wide open, I refuse to say, look, I'm not a zone team. I'm not a vertical team. I'm not a West Coast offense team. Right. I'm not a 3-4. I'm not a 4-3. I have to be everything when I do my ratings, and so do you. And so do we all. And so what NFL teams get to do, Bill Belichick is famous for taking his board, and they really narrow it down. Like, this is what a Patriot looks like. Well, that's much easier to stack your board. For us, we're trying to do rankings when, if we had a team philosophy on how we viewed our team, how we were going to put together our team, if we were really, truly general managers, the way that we stacked that board would look a lot different than how we try to rank it for 32 teams. So we're trying to be general manager for 32 teams, which is ludicrous because they're all so very, very different. And so people can try to poke holes at our rankings, and no one likes to have holes poked in what you do. But the fact is, we're actually, by being so wide open and broad, we actually are handcuffed in that way. It's not a freeing thing. It's really more of you're handcuffed. And when I put a grade or a ranking on a player, I'm at the mercy of where he gets drafted. Once Alvin Kamara went to the Saints, I mean, if I knew Kamara was the Saints, I'd have given him a 6.6. Right. Like, it was a no-brain home run. But if Alvin Kamara went to the Giants, I don't think I would have loved it too much. So, you know, players are better fits with certain teams. And so what I try to do is, somewhere in my write-up, I just try to mention how a guy might fit. If there's something specific to how he plays, I'll try to mention it somewhere in the write-up that he may fit with this kind of team. But then, you know, stacking players 1 through 10, 1 through 20, that's something none of us can avoid. You have to do that. Same way we can't avoid doing mock drafts. Mock drafts are easily picked apart by the general public. Well, I mean, I'm just trying to predict how 32 other teams are going to draft. I really – this isn't how I rank these players. It's
right.
It's kind of ridiculous. Look at how I rank players if you want to judge me as an evaluator. Don't look at how I finish in a mock draft.
Right, exactly. I always tell people that if you can, try to look at my grade, that's the number on the right, not the rank, the number on the left.
Absolutely.
If you really want to get a better idea of that player, just as a way of seeing it. So – let's talk about some difficult evaluations. I have one that was difficult for me, and that was Chris Warren III. He was someone who, when I watched him, you look at his metrics and his 20 shuttle and his 3-cone drill were excellent. When I'd watch him on tape, you know, I didn't quite necessarily always see that bend, but I saw instances of him being able to bend and do some stop-start work. I loved, you know, obviously you love his strength and his balance, and he had some pretty soft hands, I thought. He had some potential as a pass protector, and I liked what I saw in terms of where, as a starting point for him as a decision maker, I thought it was pretty good and could get better. So he was a guy that I found difficult because there were times that I looked at him and I felt like I could probably rank him much higher on a certain, in a certain way. You know, but at the same time, I had difficulties really kind of sifting out whether he would be as good at changing direction and whether the metrics on the workout fit more than were a better fit or indicator of what he could do compared to what I was seeing on tape with him. So I'd love for you either to add your thoughts on the Warren and what you thought of him, as well as anybody else that was a difficult eval for you.
Yeah, I think for me, Chris Warren was... it was one of those things where I thought it was just ill cast as an offset running back. He's 250 pounds at Texas. He needs to get he basically needs to be squared up and rolling downhill like an Alabama back, like Bo Scarborough, like, you know, Derrick Henry. He's got to be a guy who it takes him a while to get going, which is okay. You just have to know what you're working with and put that guy in the best position to succeed. And unfortunately for him, I don't think playing offset and trying to get the motor going and the legs going quickly is, you know, all that weight is something that you really want. And so I'm the same. And then Texas moved him, obviously, they moved him to tight end. And so when I was looking at him, I had to say, well, let me remember when he was a freshman. I went back to, and I happened to watch some Longhorn football. And so for me, Chris Warren, I'm like, well, I think he – and we're talking about that Chris Warren, right, the running back.
Mm-hmm.
So I just said this. Look, Chris Warren, I'll even look it up to see if I wrote this. I thought Chris Warren could potentially be a fullback. Any running back that's 250 is probably too heavy. You've got to be lighter than heavier in the NFL once you get to a certain size. But the other thing was, I just felt like he had to be a downhill back. So I really didn't care that much about what happened his final year at Texas, because that's not the kind of running back, you know, that's not the system he needs to run in. So we're basically having to operate off of memory from old games or finding old games before he got hurt and he got to playing some downhill. So it's a true projection. That was not a – you couldn't even analyze him based on the tape. You had to project him based on finding the right kind of fit. And I think he did find the right kind of fit, frankly, with Gruden. Believe it or not, he finally found somebody that – you know, Gruden maybe gets a W this offseason for one, you know, for once. But – I kind of agreed with you. I mean, I had to write him as a fullback because it looked like his running back days were over, and I was told he had no interest in being a tight end, even though Texas played him there. So that was a little bit of a tough one. I thought Deshaun Watson was a tough one, and here's why. I had two unbelievable games against Alabama, and that is pro talent. So he had two unbelievable games against pro talent. This is as good a look as you're going to get on a big stage against great talent. But on tape, there were instances where he didn't throw with great velocity. But it was usually because of, you know, leaving – just really not torquing that, the lower half and bringing his lower half through. He didn't step and drive into throws. So I figured, okay, well, as long as he – you know, remembers to do that and corrects that, he'll be okay. But then his interceptions, you watch his interceptions, just some really bad interceptions at Clemson. It's like he doesn't even see. He was baited into two really bad ones against Florida State in their game. He had a really bad half against Louisville where he just couldn't really get it going. There were times on tape where the bad decision-making or poor vision led to turnovers, and you just think, what's it's only going to get worse in the NFL. And if he's not stepping and driving the ball and he's not throwing with, you know, plus velocity, he could get himself in some trouble if he waits too long to make throws. But I've got this great leader. I've got this great athlete. I've got a guy with pretty good size. I got a guy with enough arm, and I've got a guy who has all the leadership intangibles you want and two phenomenal 400 plus yard games. So then I start thinking about, well, Vince Young did that also in college and back-to-back games against Michigan and against USC, because we always try to go into who do we have any past history where we can link this to a player. The difference between Vince and Deshaun Watson, though, is Vince Young had spotty football character. Deshaun Watson's character is football character is just off the charts. I mean, completely off the charts. And so what I learned in watching him, at least for the first seven games as a Houston Texan, is you can't not pay attention to those turnovers. Those turnovers are bad. And guess what? Those bad turnovers showed up with the Texans too. He had eight interceptions. He had some really bad throws that he had no business throwing, and they turned into interceptions. But he made explosive plays. And so I took that Deshaun Watson evaluation, and I took it as a learning exercise, and I applied it to Lamar Jackson. And that is to say, when you see a guy who has some turnover issues or – you know, occasionally some decision-making issues, be careful about how badly you know, it's one thing to beat that guy up if he's Davis Webb, but when you've got a guy who can make a ton of explosive plays, right, both with his feet and his arms, like Lamar and like Deshaun Watson, you must factor in the chunk plays, because another guy who did that was Brett Favre. Brett Favre would make some of the worst decisions and have some atrocious turnovers, but he had explosive plays that could win games as well. So balancing the mistakes versus the explosive winning plays was something that was challenging for Deshaun Watson. But I took that as a real learning experience too. And that's it. You know, football character matters a great deal. But if I see back-to-back performances in spotlight games against NFL level of competition, I've got to lean on that more heavily next time.
You know, that's a great example with Watson as well. And what do you think about the idea that when you look at Houston's game, I mean, one of the things that I noticed a lot this past year is that they used, a lot of his downfield throws weren't the high velocity kind. They were the corner routes, the deep crossers, he could throw a post and put the ball up and put some nice air under the ball. But where defenses maybe were able to maybe pin him down to an extent on the rare occasion and say, you've got to make this deep out. You've got to throw this deep comeback. Right. You've got to put more velocity on that. That's where I saw him struggle the most. So from that velocity standpoint, I'm just curious where maybe defenses might be able to adjust to that, or maybe they'll just be able to continue to say, look, with that element of his ability to improvise and to be able to move and be mobile, he can create opportunities where he's not going to get frequently pinned into that corner as often, whereas a Davis Webb would get pinned in a situation if he didn't make the correct decision and be as precise as he needed to be in the pocket.
Well, first of all, that's a great eval of Deshaun, because that's exactly what the issues were. Is there were certain throws that he was inconsistent with. But I think Bill O'Brien did a very good job. And let's remember now, he played with elite wide receiver talent when he was at Clemson too. And so I could lean on that and say, well, he had great NFL receivers, so that really helped him, you know, blah, blah, blah. But once he got with Bill O'Brien, and once again, this is still a very small sample size, but I really feel like O'Brien did a very good job of understanding where he would succeed and where he would potentially have issues, and he put him in position to succeed. And that's what the play caller's job is. That's what the head coach / quarterback coach / offensive coordinator, it's what their job is. Put a player in a position to succeed and not ask him to do more than he has to. Nate Peterman, I liked him a lot coming out of college. You can't ask him to make certain throws. He just doesn't have the arm talent to do it. And Nate, I believe, will be a self-fixer from his disastrous game last year against the Chargers. I think we'll see. He's got a tough game in week one against Baltimore. But I think Nate, one of the things I noticed where he was a disaster in Tennessee and a self-fixer at Pitt with Matt Canada, and Matt Canada put him in position to throw to space as opposed to throw to tight windows. Deshaun Watson has shown an ability to throw to both. But, you know, I think some teams may try to crowd him and force him to be more pinpoint with his passes. But the problem with that is that you have an elite ball winner in DeAndre Hopkins, who can beat you, turns 50-50 balls into 80-20s. And then you got a guy on the other side who can run a 4.240. Right. And if you crowd him too much and you don't have adequate safety help, you're going to give up a long touchdown pass, because Deshaun will take his shots down the field to Will Fuller. So the Texans just happen to have a couple of different types of wide receivers that really help Deshaun reach his potential as a passer. So I think there's kind of a perfect storm of things that work in Deshaun's favor here. I think he's always going to be a double-digit interception guy. It's what he's going to be. But because he makes explosive plays, it's a lot like in baseball. You can strike out 115 times, but if you're hitting 42 home runs, you're doing what you're supposed to do, which is producing runs. And Deshaun Watson can hit home runs. He will strike out. But at the end of the day, he's a home run hitter, and he's going to be a high OPS quarterback. And that's, you know, that's really what you're looking for. The days of the Peyton Manning dink and dunk are over. Not very many guys can extend those drives for that long. So you need guys who can make chunk plays, and Watson can make chunk plays. And I think the only thing NFL teams can do is really sit back in a shell and say, okay, big boy, dink and dunk your way down the field, and let's see what you do, and let's see if you have the patience to do it. And I think that's what you're going to see more of, teams saying, Will Fuller, we're not going to let you have your shots down the field, and we're going to make Deshaun Watson extend drives and prove that he can play smart football for extended drives.
No, that's a great analysis with that. And it's funny, that's probably one of the reasons why I'm also hoping to see Kiki QT get healthy enough and see what he can do. Even, you know, maybe down the stretch of this year, if he can get acclimated and play to the level of what he looked like at Texas Tech. Who are some guys in this year's draft class that's coming up who've caught your eye? I mean, for example, for me, I've talked about Tyree Brady out of Marshall, the wide receiver, and Emmanuel Butler out of Northern Arizona, and both are guys that I like. And just to give an quick example, some things that I like about them. I mean, Brady, certainly I like what he can do near the sideline. I think he's got some smooth skills at being able to, with his footwork. I think that he runs some pretty good routes in terms of being able to, you know, drop his weight and come to sudden stops. He catches the ball pretty well, but I like the gameness of him. Like, I look at him and I think of him against NC State's cornerbacks, and where he kind of got rolled up on a play and bent backwards and limped off a little bit and came back on the next drive, ran against that same guy, was able to, you know, execute a very good route on the play and be able to break back to the ball and then and then turn up field and just continue past. And when I see a guy who's gotten nicked and dinged up, you know, in the series before and come back like that, I like, and especially when he's been playing against a physical guy, that he doesn't shy away from that, doesn't go into a shell. I like that. And then I guess with Butler, when I see a guy have the confidence, and I know that it's a smaller school look, but have the confidence that the team does in him and also in himself, that he can face two and sometimes three guys in the red zone and win that ball in the air. And I even see kind of flashes of it against Division I teams. You know, I'm really intrigued by his, you know, let's see, hand-eye coordination, skill to win the ball and earn position. And then I like what I see with him when he makes quick hitting routes like slants and being able to get open and make that first man miss. And he has a ruggedness to his game and some quickness. I want to see how fast he's going to be. So these are two guys that I'm intrigued with. Who are guys that have caught your eye?
Well, as far as Brady, I looked at him this summer. Something that really stood out to me that I think is a great NFL skill and a very specific NFL skill is, and this is where I think DeAndre Hopkins really shines, and this is the ability to create space in a phone booth as a pass catcher. When you can create your own catch space, that is an essential NFL skill that guys either have or they don't have due to size and body control. And I thought his late adjustment ability, where he could create space and make late sudden catches, that's how the NFL is. Quarterbacks will put the ball on you right on top of you out of your breaks. So you got to be able to make the late catch, make the sudden catch, have sudden hands, and then create that enough catch space for yourself that you can secure those combat catches. So I thought that was a big plus for him too. A guy that really – staying on wide receiver, that really stood out to me was Olabisi Johnson from Colorado State. I tell you what, I just really liked watching him play. I thought he looked like a pro out there on the field. Alvis Whitted, who was a wide receiver in the league, is the position coach over there. And I think it shows up when you have a guy who has great body control, very good balance when the way he runs his routes. He's got good size. He catches it away from, you know, his body and has really natural hands. He uses subtle movements in his routes too. And I think that's something, there's a lot of guys who can get open because of scheme or because of their athletic ability. But I see a player right here in Olabisi Johnson who has the ability to get open in part because he understands how to get micro separations that can open windows early on. Just get those initial early separations, and he does it through his routes, and he's got good push getting off, you know, off the ball into his routes, because that's so important also, is to sell that vertical push, because the faster you can make those corners start to open their hips, the faster you can set them up in terms of breaking down and coming back to the ball. So I thought Olabisi Johnson was a guy that right off the bat reminded me. I put Golden Tate on there because he had some, was reminiscent a little bit of Golden Tate when I watched him. And I think he's a guy that you need to keep your eye on as the process moves on. I was really impressed with him. And Marquise Brown. Marquise Hollywood Brown is 160 pounds. But man, when the ball is in his hands, he is so unbelievably explosive. It's just that 160 pound guys don't get drafted early. So he's got to put some weight on. Another guy that really stood out was Zach Moss, running back out of Utah. And he was a human bulldozer. Just, I'm looking at my notes right now and listen to how many of these notes, and this is, I would write down a note as I was watching tape. Okay. This is in order. Takes his time in reading the defense and maintains poise. Loads up lead shoulder to punish the tackler when finishing. Aggressive demeanor. Clicks in once he decides to hit it downhill, can bulldoze tacklers, runs through arm tackles, runs behind his pads, gives booming power in the hole, falls forward as a rusher, runs through contact, violent, raging bull, controlled short stepper in his I put can create on his own. But a lot of that just refers to a very physical, aggressive style. But when I watch it, it's what an NFL player looks like. Like, there are some guys who are wiggle players. There are some guy who are, you know, we've talked about this, Matt. There's different types. Know your types. Well, he's the type that will hit you in the mouth. And That's who he is, and he doesn't try to be anything other than what he is. And I love the fact that he plays to who he is. When I watch Chris Carson run, I was reading an article on Chris Carson. Of course, Chris Carson is the running back in Seattle who came out of Oklahoma State, and he was one of the last guys that I wrote up. And I don't know, he's in the last 50 I wrote up, I think. And I was reading an article where the guys in his – because I always read articles on guys that I'm going to be writing up. I want to try to figure out who they are. It's like a – you know, you're doing a personality profile too as much as you can. And there was an article about how players in his own running back room kind of made fun of him for thinking that he's a – you know, thinking that he's some kind of sweet-footed, you know, scat back and a guy who wanted to be pretty. And they just got into him about needing to be more physical and – stop being so pretty all the time. And you could see the violence in some of his runs his final season. And it kind of started showing up. And he was a different kind of runner in 2016 than he was in 2015. And I said, bottom line, Carson is an immediate winner of the eyeball test, but that hasn't always been true in his running style. His shift from finesse to more power-based running style fits his size and physical attributes and gives him a better shot of playing on Sundays. Carson's suited to a downhill attack that allows him to be the hammer rather than the nail, but he's unlikely to create for himself with elusiveness or speed. If Carson works out well, he could hear his name called on day three. You know, once he decided that he was going to be a guy who was downhill and play to his size and figured out this is who I am, that's when he started to have some success. And I think when players figure out who they are and they embrace it, whether they're cornerbacks, you know, MJ Stewart knows who he is. He's a physical corner who's looking to whoop your ass, and that's who Carlton Davis is. They're not trying to be pretty cornerbacks. They want to physically beat you up. They know who they are. Well, Zach Moss from Utah knows who he is. So when you're watching Utah football this year, you will notice Zach Moss. I promise you. And I expect him to be a second round pick. You know, when he ends up coming out, I think he's that kind of back.
Yeah. I love backs like that. I mean, I remember reading, I don't remember who was the offensive lineman for LSU who said, no one likes to hit someone harder on our team than Spencer Ware. And so, and I fell in love with Spencer Ware very early on watching him play because of the way that he plays. And so when I hear you talk about Zach Moss, I'm looking forward to watching him. And it's funny because when you read the Chris Carson profile, I remembered reading that profile after I had evaluated him and written him up. And I went to look to see what you thought of him. And I read that. And I remember a lot of that when you mentioned that. Now, I was going to ask you about your NFL, you know, network gig and how that's maybe influenced or changed your approach to scouting. And certainly if you want to touch on that, please do. But you mentioned earlier about Chris Ballard being a mentor. So I wondered if you, you know, if you felt like it, either, you know, talk about the network gig or also, you know, some things that maybe you've learned from getting a chance to talk with a guy like Ballard.
Yeah, let me start with Ballard. So I met him in 2004. He was introduced to me by a guy named Danny Arnold, who trained Haloti Ngata, Julius Peppers, Charles Woodson, pretty good players, Casey Hampton, right. Sean Rogers, Derek Johnson. They were all training here in Houston at his little place out in the Stafford area. And this is before, you know, the APIs / XOs became the really big thing. Is there were guys who would come here and grind it out with Danny and NFL scouts who lived in Houston, including Alonzo Highsmith and Reggie Cobb and Chris Ballard. They would, you know, go out to see Danny, and I got to know those guys because they would listen to my radio show, because I've been doing a radio show in Houston, Sports Talk, a morning show, since 97. And I got into it when I was really young. And then I transitioned into this kind of draft stuff back in the early, like 2001 is when I first got started, you know, getting serious about draft stuff. Anyway, I met Chris and we hit it off. We talk a lot about the Rockets, the Astros, the Office, you know, the TV show, stuff like that. But I really learned a lot about philosophy, and it, you know, he taught me some specific things, but it was really more about philosophy of building teams, the importance of the trenches, the importance of setting tones on the offensive and defensive lines. How teams who build from outside in, it's a little harder to sustain. You know, the Falcons use that mode when they trade away Julio, traded so many picks for Julio Jones. And it took a while for them to get that, you know, return on the investment because they had to get their offensive line right. And I think, you know, a big part of that was probably Kyle Shanahan and his understanding of how to use a zone scheme when he came in. But Chris really taught me a lot about being humble when you miss. He doesn't mind missing. He said, you know, he said, hey, when you miss, it's okay to miss. Just find out why you missed, because everyone misses. And when you hit something, don't sit there and watch your home run, because the fact is you've got to go keep finding guys and finding guys. He taught me a lot about and a lot of this also happened because I just studied what teams were doing in terms of organization building. How are teams winning? Why are they winning? Well, they're drafting. And so I would bring it up to Chris. Well, you know, what are your thoughts on free agency? What are your thoughts on this? He would tell me a player who everyone was talking about, Mel Kiper and McShays and all the media types, would have a high grade on a guy. And Chris would be the one to tell me, what? That guy's going to be a day, you know, well, they didn't say day three at the time. It was, you know, but he's going to be a fifth or sixth rounder at best. And I didn't, you know, and I'd have to find out, well, why? And he'd start to talk about some of their physical deficiencies and things like that, or maybe even a character deficiency. So I really learned a lot about value of draft picks, understanding that you could love a player. And I talked about this earlier, love a player in the fourth round. And that just because you said he was a fourth rounder doesn't mean you like him any less than if you had somebody that you were looking at in the first or second round. It's just certain guys get slotted in certain places. Now, I also learned from him being with when he was with the Bears, you know, the Bears' philosophy of you got to draft pass rushers. Pass rushers make it easier to find cornerbacks. Pass rushers make life easier on your safeties. There's a certain philosophy there that not all teams share. And so I started to differentiate what Ballard and his teaching was based on who he learned from and Jerry Angelo versus what other teams thought and what Alonzo Highsmith was learning from, you know, when I talked to Zoe, what he was learning from Ted Thompson and from Ron Wolf and that, you know, that group of guys. And then Bill Belichick, I talked to a guy named Marvin Allen, who was with the New England Patriots, and how did the Patriots view this? And so, but Ballard was really influential for me on recognizing what the infrastructure of building should look like and what it looks like to be consistent as an evaluator, how to be consistent as an evaluator. But, you know, once it came time to turn the tape on and start putting my name on these on a national, because I did it, and I think I did a pretty good job, the sideline view, you know, my own website and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
But once I had to do it for the masses to pick, you know, to pick at I'll be honest with you, and you'd love this, Matt, because I know who you are. Once I got my hands on tape, on college tape with an Xbox controller that you utilize to run back and forth, I remember I watched Titus Davis from Central Michigan. I must have watched Titus Davis tape for like 2 hours. I was so giddy that I had tape in my hands. And I would watch Trey Waynes like in slow motion, every little step he took out of his back pedal. And it was really a discovery process. The more tape you watch, the more you learn and the more you become self-taught. Now, I have critical factors and critical traits that I look for at every position that I picked up along the way from three different teams who basically got me what amounts to scouting manuals. And a lot of it revolves around the old Bill Parcells, you know, theory. And a lot of NFL teams have the same. It's the same concept. It's not any trade secret. But you keep reading those things. Here's what I'm looking for quarterbacks. Here's what I'm looking for running backs. Here's what I'm looking for linebackers. You remember those as much as you can. You make it part of who you are. And then when you're watching tape, ooh, there's what that looks like. I remember having a discussion with the defensive backs coach, and I said, what do instincts look like? I'm looking at DBs and safeties. I really need to know what, you know, how to really define instincts. And he said, honestly, Lance, you'll know them when you see them. He said, but the one thing you need to know is when you're seeing a guy moving before the ball's even thrown, he just has a recognition. And he said, do you play basketball? I said, yeah. And he said, what were you best at? I said, I was a good passer and I was a decent rebounder for my size, 6'2". He said, why were you a good rebounder? I said, and I knew he had made his point. It's because I could recognize the trajectory of the ball, and I had instincts for where the carom was going to go, and I could beat the other guy to the spot. And I was a good passer because I recognized spatial relationships and I could anticipate. And so at that moment, I figured out what quarterbacks need to look for with anticipatory throws. At the same time, I figured out what instincts need to look like for safeties and cornerbacks. They have a feel at the same time or earlier than what the wide receiver will be thinking, or even quarterback. So, but all that happens only with, excuse my language, but a shit ton of tape work. I mean, it just takes time over and over and over and over until you finally see it enough that you say, okay, this is what it's supposed to look like. I feel comfortable. And then the next year, you're like, oh no, I feel overwhelmed. I forgot everything I learned. And, you know, every year is like a brand new year where it's like, oh, I hope I'm doing this right. And then you realize, okay, once you get started, you get into a rhythm. But I think Ballard really helped me learn what it's supposed to look like from a consistency standpoint and being true to your process as an evaluator. And don't get emotional about these players. You can't afford to get emotional. And it's hard not to. You get excited about players or you get down on players, but you better keep your mind open to them being not as good as you think or better than you think.
And I think that's such a fantastic answer for all of that. And it's kind of leads into the final question for this, because, you know, you talked about, you know, getting to have that experience of being around people who've built teams or who've been a part of that team building process. And I really value what you talk about with the consistency factor. I came from more of a management perspective before I got into this. And so a lot of what I did was, you know, quality work. I did operations work. I did quality work. I had to deal with that on a regular basis for well over a decade. And so one of the things that I brought to help learn was a process that worked for how to evaluate performance and really what were kind of a best practice with grading. So, you know, in the interactions that I've had with some people who've been in the league and who had bought the book and talked to me years later and kind of said, you know, the things that you talked about that were, you know, critical, and I don't mean it in a bashing sort of way, but more critical of the where the league could get better in a certain way. And some of it I said because of what I'd seen from, you know, someone like Bill Parcells talking on Draft Confidential, you know, on ESPN or at the big networks and sharing some of the things that they did. And I thought, it's interesting because their football knowledge is so great, you know, but their process is kind of more of, I've learned this from the guy who I learned from. I learned this from experience, from doing certain things and having that evolve. And I kind of looked at it and I was like, it's interesting to look at a process like the grading scale. And I look at like the NFL's grading scale being like a numbers range, a range of numbers, and you assign a number. And, you know, I see that. And sometimes I feel that that's a critical, I'm critical of that because I see it as something that can be more specific in terms of, what does a 1 stand for, or a 4 stand for, or for a 7 stand for? And while there's a sentence long description of what that is, you know, I wonder how, you know, each team, I have to imagine that there are some teams that really define more than a sentence long what that number stands for and what that is. I mean, if they don't, then, you know, then I could see where there needs to be a better definition, because you can gather people in a room and have, you know, people with varying levels of experience and expertise. And if they're having to define something with a wide variation in it, you can look at the same player and wind up with a pretty wide variation of grade, not based on the knowledge and experience, but because that actual process isn't defined as well as it could be. So I'd love for you to comment on that or any other process that you've discovered that you look at and say, I could see how this could be different, or I'd like to see how this could be changed.
So yeah, I get frustrated with my own grading scale that we have. I kind of stepped into it at NFL and I'd like to make some changes to it, but I'll be honest with you. I've never gotten fully comfortable with my own grading scale. And I think the way NFL teams do it is really a lot better. But once again, they're not doing it for 500 players. They're doing it for a more streamlined. I mean, they may look at that many. They'll look at 700, 800, but they really fine tune the list of guys they're targeting. And so it becomes a little easier to simplify the grading scales. I will tell you that an NFL grading scale, and I've looked at a few of them, they are more defined. They're defined like you would think. They say this player should be able to immediately step in and help with special teams. He's a player who may lack certain physical traits, but makes up for it in another area. We want him to have speed. It is much more well thought out, the grading scales. There's a lot more that is team specific in the grading scales. So I think, at least for some of the teams I've looked at, I think they do have a pretty good feel for it. What an NFL team will do that I don't currently have the same ability to do is they'll say, okay, this player is a 53. You'll always hear Daniel Jeremiah refer to that. I don't know, sometime on the air, maybe not, but he and I, when I talk, he uses a scale that I think he learned with the Ravens, I believe. And he'll call somebody like, he's a 54. And I got to, what's 54? 54 is a career backup a guy who has a chance to be career backup but may not be able to stay with the team more than 3 or 4 years. This guy is a 52. A 52 just means – and it's a very narrow – like once you're 54, that's what you are. You're 54. There's not – well, I'm a 5.47 or 5.43. It's – you're a 54. Now, we can argue in our draft meetings about if we're going to give you a 5.4 plus or a 5.4 minus – but you're a 5.4 guy. What's a 5.7 guy? 5.7 guy is a good quality backup who could step in and do an adequate job as a starter if need be. A 59 would be, and once again, these are kind of, I'm just kind of randomly throwing numbers, but a 59 might be an eventual, a good young player who needs to start on the bench, but is an eventual starter. So they have very clearly defined categories with NFL teams where mine are much more vague, much more wide open. And sometimes I think it would be much easier for me to really get across my thoughts on who I think a player is if I was able to take it down to just the basics of, you know, 7 different types of players or 8 different types of players. And I will tell you that I think NFL teams do a pretty good job of creating that. I have not created my own draft scale where I felt completely comfortable with. And I think it's, you know, it's easier when you're saying, well, he's a first rounder, a second rounder. You want to verbally say what you think of a player, but it is much harder. It's much more rewarding, but it's also much harder when you have to put a number grade on them because, you know, there's always these variances. You never feel fully comfortable because you say, well, you know, if he can keep weight on, he's a 6.1. If not, he's a 5.8. Well, you know, if he stays healthy, he's a 6.3. Well, if he's had an injury history in college, you can't say if he stays healthy. He's going to, you know, what are you, pick one. Are you going to project him to be a healthy NFL player or a not healthy NFL player? You got to make a pick. You got to put your name on it. And so NFL teams and scouts and evaluators, they got to put their name on it. So when they put a grade on there, they're stamping it. There's not a lot of, you know, it's kind of inflexible, but I like that in a way.
Well, I'm going to stamp this episode of this podcast with great deal of approval. And I hope that everyone got the chance to enjoy this pod with Mr. Lance Zierlein. You can definitely check him out at NFL.com, NFL Network, and also, you know, his radio show in Houston at 97.5. Lance, thanks so much for being a guest today.
Oh, man, I love talking shop with you, Matt, anytime.
Oh, man, this is great. And everyone out there, thanks again for reviewing and rating the RSP cast, which has been, you know, a few months old right now. I appreciate the feedback, and we will stay tuned. We will see you again next week or something like that. I don't know. I've run out of gas, folks. Thanks.